I'm speaking with Joseph Nye, who's Harvard University's Distinguished Service Professor and former Dean of the Kennedy School of Government. He has served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Chair of the National Intelligence Council, and Deputy Undersecretary of State for Security Assistance, Science and Technology. He's the author of Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics, Understanding International Conflict, The Power Game, a Washington novel, and The Power to Lead. His latest book, just published, is The Future of Power. And it would seem to me that, Joseph Nye, that particularly in terms of the internet, which is a big part of your book, and how it's going to change the power relationship between the citizen and the government, we sure saw that in Egypt, didn't we?
Yeah, fascinating. Basically, the conventional wisdom was that you had no choice but to support either Mubarak or you'd wind up with the Muslim Brotherhood. And what we hadn't realized, or many analysts hadn't realized, that the enormous flow of information in Egypt had created a new middle. And what's more, new devices like Twitter and Facebook and so forth were allowing these people to coordinate in ways they'd never done before. So this is part of what I call in the book the diffusion of power. Basically, that governments still remain the most important actors, but they're nowhere near as fully in control as they used to be.
And where does this place us in terms of this argument over realpolitik, and that is that we act according to our so-called interests as opposed to according to our ideals? And it would seem to me that we may be reaching a point now where it is more in our national interest to act according to our ideals rather than in our so-called interests.
That's right. I think you have to distinguish between short-run stability, supporting an existing government, and long-run stability, which may be aligning your views with the people in Tahrir Square. What we see in terms of how the foreign policy leaders have to deal with these issues is they're caught trying to walk a tightrope. On the one hand, they have to deal with governments and with hard power. After all, Egypt balances Iranian power. Egypt's important to the peace process in the Middle East and so forth. But on the other hand, if they don't have a narrative which attracts people in Tahrir Square, then they're not going to have much power in the future. So classically, people say, you know, who wins is whoever has the biggest army. In today's age, information age, it's also whose story wins. And you've got to do both of those things. You have to have the ability to deal with governments and classical interests, but you also have to have a narrative that appeals to civil society. That's not easy.
But do you think, Joseph Nye, that over the decades, because throughout the Cold War, national security was rather narrowly defined, mostly in terms of bean counting with missiles versus missiles, but I don't recall a broader definition of national security, including economic and social, and what, broadly speaking, soft power that you've written about. So are we sort of belatedly discovering our soft power? Because arguably, the Cold War ended in part because of MTV and rock and roll as much as anything else.
Well, that's right. Essentially, we did better with soft power than we've done with our analytical explanations of what happened or how the Cold War ended. One of the reasons for writing this book on the future of power is to get Americans and others to think in a much more sophisticated way about what is the source of power and how does it work. If you look at the Cold War, when the Berlin Wall went down, it didn't go down under a barrage of artillery. It went down under hammers and bulldozers wielded by people whose minds had been changed by Western values and information, which meant they no longer believed in communism. That's an important role of soft power, but we don't talk about it that way. We think it was all the balance in bombs and missiles, and that's a big mistake analytically.
Again, I'm speaking with Joseph Nye, the author of a new book, The Future of Power. I'm wondering, though, whether our foreign policy and military and intelligence establishment is sufficiently nimble, because I remember years ago talking with Paul Netzer about the paranoia in the 70s about Soviet power, and he said that there was an idea floated in the foreign policy establishment called geopolitical indigestion, where maybe it'd be better to let the Soviets take over all of Africa, and because ultimately that was their downfall, their empire. I remember meeting people in Russia who used to travel to Czechoslovakia for their vacations because the Czechs had it better than they did. I mean, what a bizarre empire where the periphery is better off than the center, you know?
Well, that's true. And one of the big problems that the Soviets had was their inability to open up and adapt to the information revolution. Central planning helped them build missiles, tanks, trucks, and so forth in the what you might call the second industrial revolution of the middle of the 20th century. But they were no good when it came to dealing with the so-called third industrial revolution, the role of computers and communications. If you think of it as in the metaphor of a hand, a central planning system was all thumbs and no fingers. And this is what basically undercut their power. If they'd had the ability to free things up and to get away from this central planning, they might have done better. But they couldn't do that because of their political system.
But what about our political system, in as much as the military-industrial complex does have enormous power in shaping our foreign policy and our defense and intelligence policy, I guess, now, with all this privatization? I'm wondering whether we are sufficiently nimble, given, for example, you know, 1999 to 1991, the world changed radically. Subnational and transnational threats took over the strategic landscape, and national threats have gone away. And they may come back, but they've gone away. So I don't think that we've adapted to even that reality, which is decades away.
Well, we're making some progress, but we're not there yet. For example, if you look at Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld when he was in office, he said, and is quoted in the Financial Times as saying, "I don't understand soft power." By 2007, his successor, Secretary of Defense Gates, gave a speech in Kansas City saying we had to invest more in our soft power. And he said it might seem odd that the head of the Pentagon is pleading for more resources for the State Department, but that's the way the world is. And, of course, Secretary of State Clinton in the Obama administration talked about smart power, the ability to combine hard and soft power into successful strategies. So essentially there's a greater understanding among key security policy makers that you need to integrate soft and hard power, but it's slow. It's just very hard to do, and what we have is a government where the Defense Department has great operational capacities and the other agencies don't, so you have one giant and a lot of pygmies, and trying to change that is certainly something that the top leaders talk about, but it's hard to turn a superbanker.
But Joseph Nye, it would seem, though, just from the recent foreign policy misadventures of George W. Bush, that we have had in Iraq and Afghanistan two quick victories followed by slow defeats, and arguably because we didn't deliver on the soft power. The military delivered very quickly, but there wasn't that follow-up that created the stability and made the people feel that their lives were better. And that certainly is what's haunting us in Afghanistan. And in fact, the Bush administration took money away from nation building, which of course they didn't like in Afghanistan. You know.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we went through a period in the first decade of the 21st century where we had a feeling that since the Soviets had collapsed, we were so strong militarily that we could do whatever we wanted, and others had no choice but to follow. That was a classic strategic blunder. Now we're trying to get a better sense of balance, but as I said, it's slow.
But in your book, Joseph Nye, The Future of Power, you draw a kind of dichotomy between liberals and realists in terms of our foreign policy tradition. And I'm wondering, though, that my understanding at least in the last few decades, is that the struggle has been between the kind of tradition, if you will, of realpolitik, exemplified by Henry Kissinger, and this kind of insurgent movement of neoconservatism, beginning with the Committee on the Present Danger under Jimmy Carter, and that I thought that that was the struggle between the kind of reckless utopianism of the neocons and the somewhat bankrupt policy, at least looking at what's happening in the Middle East today, of the practitioners of realpolitik.
Well, that's right. There was, with the neoconservative approach that became very popular in some parts of the Bush administration, that was another strand. So Rumsfeld might be seen, for example, as a traditional realist, and you take somebody like Paul Wolfowitz in the Defense Department, he was very much a neoconservative. President Bush seemed to go back and forth between them, but sometimes sound like a neoconservative. I think that in that sense, there is more than just the traditional dichotomy of realists and liberals. I think what I'm trying to argue in my book is that traditional dichotomy doesn't serve us well. That's why I say somewhat facetiously that I consider myself a liberal realist, because I don't think either of those traditions has the full answers.
And you're taking the argument further, though, from soft power into smart power. So can you give our audience a kind of quick sketch of what you mean there?
Well, it'd be nice if the world could deal or do things, or we could do things with soft power alone. After all, power is the ability to affect others to get what you want, and you can do it three ways. You can do it with coercion, you can do it with payments, or you can do it with attraction and persuasion. And the last of those is soft power. But alas, we're still in a world in which coercion and payments play important roles. And the ability to try to combine military, economic, and soft power in an effective strategy is smart power. If you look at Obama's efforts in responding to the insurrection in Egypt, it was in many ways a smart power strategy. He did not immediately call for the overthrow of Mubarak, which might have caused chaos in terms of some larger interests in the short term, but he did use American hard power in the form of our military aid to Egypt to press the Egyptians and the Egyptian army not to fire on the demonstrators. And at the same time, increasingly, he and Hillary Clinton and others used language which indicated that our desire for what they put as an orderly transition to democracy. That walking of the tightrope may look like it was a bit of wobbling from time to time, but nonetheless, he seems to have crossed the abyss without falling off the tightrope on one side or the other. That would be an example of smart power.
Let me remind the audience again, if I may. I'm speaking with Joseph Nye, the author of a new book, The Future of Power. So, given our enormous defense budget now, which is, I believe, as high as it's been since World War II. At least it's hard to know when you get these arguments, but my understanding is if for inflation-adjusted dollars, we're spending more than almost the rest of the world combined, but certainly more than all of our possible enemies combined and our allies as well. Do you think, when you talk about, in the beginning of your book, about President Obama's inaugural, where he talked about the prudent use of power, it seems to me that we have just witnessed in the last decade an absolutely extraordinary decline of U.S. power and influence, where our deterrence, while spending record amounts of money, we still don't have deterrence. Now, I don't know that you can have deterrence against people living in caves bent on destroying us, but there has to be some kind of proportionality here, surely. I mean, the Soviets, when we were spending less on them and they could destroy every city in the United States in 30 minutes, and yet we're running around chasing after a tactic, not after a real enemy, spending more, and seems to me getting less.
Well, I think you're right if one applies the military to the question of terrorism. You can't solve the problem of terrorism with hard power alone. You have to basically prevent the hardcore terrorists, the bin Ladens of this world, from attracting the mainstream Muslims to what is rather a extreme fringe ideology of that al-Qaeda represents. So in that sense, it's a little bit like the analogy to the Cold War and how the Berlin Wall came down. You can't win this with hard power alone, and that was one of the mistakes, I think, that Bush made in Iraq. On the other hand, what I argue in the first chapter of the book about military power is that it's not obsolete. If you look at East Asia, for example, the presence of the United States Navy and Air Force in East Asia and alliances with Japan and South Korea are very welcome, so much so that the Japanese pay most of the costs of the American military presence there. And that ability to balance the rise of Chinese hard power gives the Americans important soft power in East Asia. The American presence is welcomed in East Asia, not rejected. So it's important to not to say that because you can't conquer a country like Iraq or Afghanistan, that there's no role of military power. What it means is that when you're looking at military power, it's worth going back to Dwight Eisenhower's advice from the 1950s, which is avoid involvement in land wars in Asia. But it doesn't mean that you would avoid having, for example, a significant presence in Japan or South Korea, where we're welcome.
But surely you could make an analogy here, not so much with Eisenhower in the Middle East. And it's worth remembering that back in 1956, it was President Eisenhower who pulled the British and the French and the Israelis over for their attack right. on Suez. And I think that was the high point in U.S. influence, but in the Middle East. But if you look back at the first Gulf War under President Bush's father, the U.S. got the Saudis and the Japanese and others to pay for that war and maintained their hegemony in the Gulf in the extent to which they are the guarantors of the energy supplies of all of their economic rivals, the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Europeans, and without any of stirring up these hornet's nests that the Sun did. And it seems to me that the comparison between the end of the Gulf War and where we're at today is extraordinary, and that we may still have the Asian tigers on our side because they're afraid of China, but it looks like the Middle East, our influence has disappeared precipitously, and now we're stuck with the possibility that our big linchpin, the Saudis, are getting shaky, and God knows what we'll do then.
Well, you're right in contrasting Bush 41 and Bush 43, as they're sometimes called. When the father was preparing the coalition, he didn't need all those troops from all the other Arab countries to be able to defeat Saddam's armies in Kuwait. But by having those other countries involved, he added to the legitimacy of the coalition. The Sun didn't understand that as well. He basically went for it more on his own, and by having a sense of a loss of legitimacy led to a strong reaction against his policy. So you're exactly right. You can't solve things by force alone. Legitimacy and morality are a power reality. They're not the only power reality. You need both hard power and soft power. But the United States, if it's going to be able to have an influence in the Middle East, has some influence from its military capacity, but it also has to have a legitimacy and moral capacity. And that's what I mean in the book when I argue against people who think that we can use traditional terms of, you know, it's just whose army wins. It's not. It's whose army and whose story wins.
Again, I'm speaking with Joseph Nye, the author of a new book, The Future of Power. But we clearly, Joseph Nye, we are probably going to be facing some serious challenges and choices very soon. What seemed to have happened in the last few days in Bahrain was that the king and the crown prince tried to, you know, navigate the the anger of their Shiite majority who were taking to the streets. And then it looks as though it was the Saudis who came in and shot up a lot of those people. And now they're trying to sort of, you know, the dust is settling a little bit. But the long and the short of it is that we know that the Saudi kings are terrified of what's happening, and we don't really know much about where the young Saudis stand, you know, particularly given the kind of contagion of democracy spreading via the internet and with these tech-savvy young Arabs who are influenced, interestingly enough, by an American, Gene Sharp, there in Boston, I understand.
An old friend of mine.
He is. Well, he's doing. That man is doing so much, don't you think?
it's remarkable. Gene has worked on this idea of nonviolence throughout his life, and it's nice to see him finally getting the recognition he deserves. And that's a great example of soft power. But I think your point about the Saudis is correct. They're uncertain of what things are happening. They're very worried, and whether they'll have an uprising, as we've seen in other countries, is not so clear. They have a much stronger tribal basis and a much stronger religious, conservative religious support system. But they are worried, and as for their interest in Bahrain, I think they are particularly worried that some of the violence in Bahrain might spill back into the Shia eastern province of Saudi Arabia. But I think it is worth noticing that if the Washington Post report today is correct, that President Obama called the Bahraini leaders after the shootings in Pearl Square and said, stop, this is a bad idea, and the Americans put strong pressure on for negotiation, which then meant that the army was withdrawn and the protesters were able to reoccupy Pearl Square. We don't know the last act in this play yet, but I think Obama was correct in the steps that he took.
But in terms of the powers of realpolitik weighing in on this situation, given the Saudi situation vis-a-vis world energy as the largest supplier of oil in the world, even though, according to some of these WikiLeaks documents, they may have exaggerated their reserves by 40%. But the long and short of it is, I imagine, all the sort of strategists are sort of saying, you know, we've got to stick by Saudi Arabia no matter what, and as opposed to Egypt. And yet, to my mind, Saudi Arabia's had an incredibly malignant effect in radicalizing Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I'm just wondering, in the overall picture, would we be better off sort of just, you know, taking a punt and hoping that things work out better there?
Well, it depends on what taking a punt means. If the Saudis are the major balancer in the world oil markets, if something happens there, if there's conflict inside Saudi, or if something happens which shuts down their oil supply, you could see oil prices going over $200, $300 a barrel, which would have devastating effects on the world economy and knock us back into a very bad recession. So in that sense, even though one would hope to see an evolution toward democracy in Saudi Arabia, foreign policy is more than just a human rights policy. It's also a policy aiming to get as many as one's interests and values as one can. So in that sense, what happens to Saudi Arabia is very important. An orderly transition is very different from a disorderly transition.
But we have, there have been various scenarios expressed, in the last few years, Joseph Nye, about the possibility of a preemptive strike against Iran because of their apparent determination to build a nuclear weapon, which apparently they're now making their decision whether to go ahead. They pretty much got all their ducks in a row. They just haven't made that decision. That's as much as I know about it, but you may know more, but the long the short of it is we've heard many scenarios from hardline Israelis saying that they, if we don't do it, they will eventually. And then when you talk to our strategists, they say, well, that would be a disaster, because the first thing the Iranians would do would be go after Abqaiq and shut down the Saudis. And so the scenario that we're talking about could happen. I'm just wondering, at this point, given the veto that the U.S. had to take against a position which it actually holds, which is to stop settlements in the West Bank, the fear that the Netanyahu government has over the Egypt contagion spreading and affecting these important treaties they have. Where do we stand vis-a-vis our relations with Israel and the possibility of Israel doing something that could precipitate the very thing that we're talking about?
Well, I think a military attack on Iranian nuclear facilities, whether by the U.S. or by Israel, would probably have very negative unintended consequences. For one thing, you'd have what you mentioned, the effect on the oil price, which has the effect on what's happening in the world economy and the efforts to recover in the world economy. But over the longer term, it might have a negative effect of basically stopping the positive generational change that in the longer term is in our interest by driving them into the arms of the nationalists and the mullahs. So I don't think that is a wise strategy. It's interesting that according to David Sanger's book, The Inheritance, the Israelis came to President Bush in his last year in office and asked about a military attack, and even Bush said no.
Well, at this point, though, the last thing that the U.S. needs in its terms of its foreign policy in the Middle East is having to cast this veto, it seems, you know, when we're trying to sort of signal to the Arab street that we're on their side. So I'm just wondering whether this situation in Egypt, which has sort of changed the calculus there, will have a more moderating effect, and the realist in Israel will be more inclined to make a deal, or will this make the hardliners more powerful, given that Hezbollah is on the rise, Jordan is shaky, Egypt is shaking, and the argument might be, well, we're even more under threat now and under siege.
But I think that would be short-sighted. I think that if the hardliners do prevail, they're not going to develop a strategy which would essentially lead to a longer-term solution and peace in the Middle East. So we don't know what will happen inside Israeli politics, but I think that would be the wrong direction for them to go.
Again, I'm speaking with Joseph Nye, author of the new book, The Future of Power. Let me just, in the last couple of minutes, turn to the future, if you will, given the emergence of China. And China has, in terms of, and you have a graph in your book of the various kind of measurements of power, and one of which, of course, is nuclear weapons. China has not, it's got about 200, I believe, ballistic, we got 2,700. That's going to come down with the START agreement. But the long and the short of it is they seem to have exercised some restraint in terms of their nuclear posture. But clearly, if, as you say, they will pass us, their economy will pass us, what, in 2047, I think it was?
Well, it's in actually, Goldman Sachs says in size that the Chinese economy will equal to the U.S. in 2027,
sir.
But equality in size is not equality in composition, which is measured by per capita income. And there, the Chinese will be another decade or two beyond that, if then.
But clearly, as their economy gets bigger, therefore the percentage, of even if they're keeping their percentages low and compared to us in terms of what we spend on the military, they're still going to have a substantial military, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's showing not in their nuclear threat, because you're correct on that, as much as in their efforts to increase their naval power. And there you see the Chinese making significant investments.
So what is our strategy there? Because I know during the Bush administration, there were some rather, again, the neocons were doing some reckless things with Taiwan. You recall the Orion that was that crash landed in China,
right?
And apparently, the Chinese were so miffed with Rumsfeld that they chopped the plane up and FedExed it to his home address.
So, well, and also took a number of secrets out of it en route.
Oh, they apparently got a lot of secrets out of it.
But I think the right strategy for dealing with the rise of China is to know that we have to balance Chinese military power. I mean, that's the way the world is. And so India, Japan, Korea, Vietnam want us to help them in that. But it would be a pity if we let that be the only strand of our strategy. We and the Chinese have some common interests, which are not power over each other, but power with each other. For example, climate change. China is now the superpower of CO2 production. We gain as China learns how to have more energy efficient and less carbon intensity in their power generation. Our pandemics, we gain as China develops the capacity to deal with general health problems. So there are a number of areas where, as we look ahead with China, there's a lot to be gained, for example, from working together on international financial stability. So it'd be a pity to see this, as some people do, as a replay of Germany passing or trying to pass Britain and leading to World War I a century ago. China's not about to pass the United States in the short run of the next couple of decades. We have time to work out what I think can be a sensible, balanced, and cooperative relationship.
Well, just in closing, since you've mentioned, Joseph Nye, that Gene Sharp, the man of the moment, if you will, is a friend of yours, and you describe yourself as a liberal realist, how would you describe Gene? Because many people have argued over the years that nonviolence is all very nice, but not particularly practical. And it seems to me that maybe we've got that wrong.
Well, nonviolence, Gene's great contribution is to say that nonviolence is often underestimated. Now, there are times when nonviolence doesn't work. Tiananmen Square is a case in point. Or the Revolutionary Guard suppression of the demonstrations in Iran a year ago is a case in point. But what's interesting to see about Egypt was, indeed, here were a group of people who were following Gandhi's advice, as channeled in part through Gene Sharp's writings, and it worked. So I think it's not that nonviolence always works. Gene may be a bit more optimistic about the conditions than I am. But he's right that under the right conditions, nonviolence is a very powerful strategy.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Joseph Nye.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Again, Joseph Nye is Harvard University's Distinguished Service Professor and former Dean of the Kennedy School of Government. He has served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Chair of the National Intelligence Council, and Deputy Undersecretary of State for Security Assistance, Science, and Technology. He's the author of Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics, Understanding International Conflict, The Power Game, a Washington Novel, and The Powers to Lead. His latest book, just published, is The Future of Power.